Hey, it's approximately 2:30 in the afternoon on April 23rd. We're here at the headquarters of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And I'm Bart DeZeeve, and this is Scott Gans from the FCIC, and we're here to interview Glenn Snyder. And for the record, can the other folks from the Federal Reserve identify themselves?
Shari Leventhal from the Legal Group.
Stephanie Ruiz, paralegal from the Legal Group.
So, Glenn, I assume you know a little bit about the FCIC. We were formed by Congress to look at the financial crisis writ large, as well as how many tasks, A to V. And some of those tasks include looking at the largest financial institutions that failed or nearly failed or would have failed but for substantial federal assistance. So obviously Citigroup's in that bucket. We're interviewing folks from the OCC, the SEC, the Board of Governors staff, and of course the staff of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I'm going to ask some questions today. Obviously my knowledge is a lot more limited than yours. If I ask a question, you know, that you don't understand or doesn't make sense to you, let me know. And better yet, if there's a question you think I should ask but I haven't, feel free to tell me what you think the right question to ask is and what the right answer is. And,
okay.
Shari will jump in if she thinks I've missed something or otherwise misstated something. I've got some documents that we're going to go through, some of which I just want to know if you've seen them before, some of which I'm going to want you to explain to me, help put them into English. That's one of the Commission's overriding goals, is to try and explain this whole thing to the American public, which can be a bit daunting.
Good luck, yes.
Try and compress without distorting is always difficult. Since we're part of the federal government, the same sort of federal statutes that cover you and your day-to-day stuff when you're interviewing banks covers us, and so anyone who attempted to mislead us would be subject to Title 18, all those criminal provisions. You know, at the end of the formal interview, I'll ask you if you have any thoughts beyond the scope of my questions, and feel free to tell us whatever you think is relevant to the committee's inquiry. So, to get started, I'd just like some general background information. How long have you been at the Federal Reserve Bank?
I started actually with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago in 1985, so almost 25 years. I spent 12 years at the Chicago Reserve Bank, and in 1997 transferred out to the New York Fed.
And how long have you been on the CPC team for Citi?
I joined the CPC team in May of 2005, and I was on that team until approximately May of 2009. After that, I actually moved out of bank supervision, so I'm no longer part of bank supervision.
So where are you?
I'm working in an area called credit and payment risk.
And what other, when you were still in bank supervision, what other large financial institutions, if you were assigned to a CPC team?
Yes.
Or
okay, I can go back. I first started as a trust examiner, actually, in both in Chicago and at New York. And as a trust examiner, I went to most of the large institutions in the Second District. As far as CPC teams, I was part of the Depository Trust and Clearing Corp team for about a year and a half. I was also on the J.P. Morgan CPC team just prior to my work with Citigroup, and that was for about a year as well.
And so you left the CPC team for Citi in May 2009.
Yes.
They're physically located in the building that's adjacent to the
yes.
headquarters of Citigroup?
Correct, 880 Third Avenue.
Is that the same building that the OCC?
I didn't finish the question because otherwise it's going to garble up on tape.
Is that the same building the OCC staff is in? Or is that different?
They're in the same building.
Same building? And approximately how many people were on the Citigroup CPC team when you left in May 2009?
On the on-site team, approximately 10, 12 people when I left.
And what were your areas of responsibility when you were on the CPC team from May 2005 to May 2009 in general?
Okay. My responsibilities changed quite a bit while I was on that team. I was initially hired, I initially transferred to that team for very specific reasons, and that was to monitor the firm's efforts around compliance risk management. And those efforts were largely a result of a board order regarding the acquisition of First American Bank and the need for Citigroup to strengthen its compliance risk management program. So I primarily was responsible for monitoring efforts regarding compliance risk management, the need to strengthen compliance monitoring, testing, and reporting processes within Citigroup. They were also developing a more independent compliance risk management structure. There was a need to improve the internal control environment, and they were working on a fairly significant project regarding the risk control self-assessment that I was monitoring. They were looking to strengthen internal audit, and I would say generally when I initially started for about the first year, my responsibilities centered around that aspect of compliance risk management.
And when you say compliance, can you give me a little more specificity? Is that like compliance with certain regulations, you know, like fair lending compliance, or is it compliance with, you know, existing board agreements? What do you mean by compliance?
It was broad. I would interpret it broadly. So compliance with laws and regulations, compliance with bank policies, Citigroup bank policies, compliance with, to some extent, internal control processes, everything that the typical corporate level compliance function would have responsibility over. There was also some aspect of compliance with the written agreement. There was a cease and desist order in place, although there was another legal and compliance risk coordinator who probably did more work regarding the consumer lending laws than I did.
So when you say cease and desist order, you're referring to the City Financial order?
Yes.
Okay. Where are we at, 21?
We are at 21.
I'm marking as F21 the written agreement dated July 2003. This was what I'm calling the post-Enron agreement. Are you familiar with that agreement in general or in specific?
I am familiar with it generally, yes.
So did part of your compliance duties include reviewing Citigroup's compliance with this written agreement?
Only on the, I would say, on the fringes. For the most part, I believe Bart Sturmasi handled the majority of the compliance with the written agreement.
Okay. So I'm going to refer you to two documents which we've previously marked as F4 and F5. These are examiner worksheets regarding a couple of CDO structures. Your name's not referenced here, but I just wanted to make sure if this was a fringe you were involved with or not.
No, I think this was an exam that I had very little to do with, frankly.
So as I understand it, you referenced independent risk management, and that a gentleman by the name of David Bushnell was the head of that function over some periods of time at Citigroup.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any personal contact with Mr. Bushnell? Was he the person at Citigroup you interacted with on?
The person we largely, well, that I largely interacted with was Martin Wong, who was the head of the compliance function. And Martin Wong reported to Dave Bushnell in his role as chief compliance officer and independent compliance risk management. We did have some general meetings with Dave Bushnell, but I had more meetings with the head of the compliance team than I did with Mr. Bushnell.
And explain, if you can, to me, what the difference is internally at Citigroup between their compliance unit and their risk management unit.
Okay. Compliance risk management largely focused on compliance with laws, regulations, bank policies, as opposed to their independent risk management functions, which were more largely interested with things as credit and market risk management. So the compliance risk management function had an independent reporting function up to Dave Bushnell, separate from the actual risk managers that were staffed through the risk management function and had business management, business line risk management responsibilities.
Going quick. So the board order approving the acquisition of Citigroup's acquisition of the First American Bank in Texas, in effect, it stated that if there were going to be significant additional acquisitions, that the Board of Governors and the Federal Reserve Bank would expect significant improvements to be made in the risk management and internal controls procedure. Can you tell me sort of what your role in looking at the I believe it was called the 5 points.
5 point plan.
Plan was and generally describe what that plan was and what your oversight activities were.
Okay, and that was probably that was largely why I was there. Again, the one of the efforts was to strengthen the independence of the compliance risk management function. Prior to me being there. I guess compliance risk management was somewhat embedded within the business lines and didn't have an independent reporting structure. So by hiring Martin Wong and having him report up to the chief risk officer, there was more of an independent structure to the compliance risk management function. Also, I believe that there were some compliance managers that were also structured within the businesses. Those functions were removed outside of the business line function and all reported up to Martin Wong as the chief compliance officer. So they had no reporting structure within the business, which also meant that their compensation was not determined in any manner by the actual business that they were operating over. So that was one of the efforts of the five-point plan. Another one was to improve the compliance monitoring, testing, and reporting function. Citigroup had a number of compliance issues prior to me arriving that were fairly public in nature. And so they had a number of a well-known compliance lapses, and they needed to better develop their monitoring function, their compliance testing function, the actual reporting of compliance issues and escalation of compliance issues. So I spent a fair amount of time of my time in that area. And in 2005, we also had an exam that was strictly, the scope of that exam was to determine the progress or improvements that city was making with respect to improving the monitoring, testing, and reporting function. Each country and each business was responsible for putting together a compliance strategy. Those strategies needed to be linked to the business strategy so that they could understand what type of compliance monitoring and testing needed to be done relative to the business strategy, if the testing was appropriate enough. So it involved a fair amount of work reviewing compliance, strategic compliance plans across the world, basically. I think there were about 200 different compliance, strategic compliance plans that the compliance managers had put together. So we reviewed some of those plans to see how robust the plans were, how robust the testing was, and if the testing was commensurate with the level of business activity that the compliance areas were, that the business areas were undertaking. We also were interested in cities' efforts to build an appropriate reporting structure. In 2005, they were in process of developing a compliance risk dashboard, which would basically escalate compliance issues up the chain so that serious compliance issues receive the appropriate attention, appropriate management, escalation, and oversight, and remediation if necessary. So that was something that was in process during 2005 and 2006. Another aspect of the five-point plan was there was a compensation aspect to the five-point plan, and that dealt with a couple of things. First, developing an appraisal process for the senior-most compliance people. I think it was initially rolled out to the top 300 senior officers at Citigroup, and that was generally a new process that was developed specific to the five-point plan. They also wanted to reinforce that the bonus structure was tied to the business areas, the pay structure was tied to the business areas' performance with respect to any internal control audit, internal control results, results from their risk control self-assessment, which is basically the business's self-assessment of their residual risks and potential gaps in controls. So if they had, repeat issues in their risk control self-assessments, which were basically like quarterly testing, eventually that would be factored into the compensation package for that senior officer. There was also an aspect to the five-point plan about the risk control self-assessment process and making certain that the employees saw the risk control self-assessment process as a key control point within Citigroup. In 2005, I think in 2006, we actually did an exam of the risk control self-assessment process, and there were a number of improvements and enhancements that Citigroup was had put forth to strengthen it, for it to become more consistent across the organization, for there to be a common set of just terms for the risk control self-assessment, and also to put all of the risk control self-assessment technology onto a single platform so that you could have a better reporting process to senior management. I believe when we first started looking at it, the number of systems that separately maintained risk control self-assessments was like 20 or 30 systems across Citigroup, across the globe. So that was a big initiative to be able to get all that technology under one system so that they could have consistent reporting across the globe. So that was a significant initiative. I believe there was also another initiative regarding just enhancing the internal audit function, and I think that had to do more around making certain that the appropriate level of staffing was in place, and that audit needed to develop a standard audit program for the compliance function. That was something that they did, I believe, in 2005 or early 2006 as well. So there was regular meetings with audit to understand their status with respect to hiring qualified auditors and putting those auditors in place. The one other piece, I guess, to the five-point plan was what they called the franchise governance reviews. And those were reviews of kind of like country reviews across the globe to make certain that they understood the business risks that the Citigroup was involved with respect to a certain country and any businesses that were conducted within that country. These were conducted by senior officials from Citigroup that would go out and visit the country and talk with some of the senior officials of Citigroup within those countries. They would also, I believe, meet with regulators within those countries to get their understanding of their impression of Citigroup and the businesses that they were conducting within those countries. And they would basically do an assessment of the franchise governance potential issues within each country. And that was done at the Citigroup corporate level. And we met regularly with the person that was responsible for doing those types of reviews just to understand what kind of issues were coming out of those reviews. You know, the reviews were also aimed at getting a good understanding of the risk culture within a given country that was in place at that country, and understanding how the culture worked and whether or not improvements to the risk to the culture needed to be made. Those were largely the five-point plan issues that I worked on, and like I said, I spent a considerable amount of my time devoted to those issues.
Would you say the five-point plan was primarily a compliance mechanism? Was it primarily a risk management mechanism, or was it a combination of both?
I saw it more as a compliance. I think there was more of a compliance aspect to it than there was a risk management. But there was also an internal control aspect, as well as just an aspect that was aimed at understanding the culture of Citigroup and making certain that culture was appropriate throughout the organization, and if need be, you know, for the senior officers of Citigroup to influence that culture to better understand potential risks, whether they were legal risks, reputational risks, or market credit related risks. It was really designed at getting a better understanding of the culture and the risk culture within Citigroup.
And can you describe generally what the risk culture at Citigroup, at the, say, the board of directors level of the corporation was, and then perhaps what the culture was in the sort of investment banking business that sometimes straddled legal entities between Citibank and the non-bank affiliates?
I think it would be difficult for me to describe it at the board level because I did not have access. Oh, I didn't meet with the board members, and I guess from any readings of the board minutes, it would be hard to say for certain what the risk culture was there. Within the individual businesses, I guess. My impression would be more from my work in the risk control self-assessments, where we would meet with a business, and they were very generally quite pleased to say we have a high rate of fully effective risk control self-assessments, and that was probably one of the first things, if we were at a business level meeting, that they would point out is the level of fully effective RICSAs. And it wasn't uncommon for them to say, well, you know, we have 90 something percent effective RICSAs. So from that, I would say that there was a lot of concern around what they viewed as their compliance with internal controls, and they made that known, and that was also something that audit reviewed as part of their regular internal audit processes as well. So they were quite pleased to tell us the percentage of effective RICSAs. I think that probably would be the biggest way I saw the level of risk taking from an operational risk perspective that I had. It's just how they were complying with internal controls and policies of sort.
So with respect to David Bushnell and his risk management group, did you ever form an impression as to whether or not Mr. Bushnell or Ms. Duke were too close to the business people to make independent risk assessments or make decisions on exceptions to limits or making decisions on increasing limits on business activity?
No, and I had never met with BB Duke, and the limited meetings I had with Dave Bushnell, I don't think I really had an impression. There was nothing that I saw that said he was too close to the business, same far, or other than in his level of independence as an independent risk manager was known just through the structure, but it would have been very difficult for me to get that impression as an operational risk person with fairly limited exposure to Dave Bushnell.
So it's not something you would have been able to judge. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it would be very difficult for me to judge that.
Okay. All right, I will mark as F22. Is that where we're at? A document dated September. That's nice. February 17th, 2006, from the Division of Banking Supervision and Regulation at the Board of Governors, and it's bait stamped 88499. And 88500. If you want to take a second to just take a look at that document. So as I understand this document generally, is that it's a recommendation from the senior staff at the Board of Governors to lift what we had discussed previously, the sort of moratorium on significant acquisitions by Citigroup. Is that sort of your understanding of that as well?
Yes, that's correct.
And your reports to the senior staff at the Board of Governors is what would have resulted in their recommendation, correct?
Yes, my reports would have informed them on this. That's correct.
And then shortly after the date of this memo, in fact, the Citigroup was notified by either the Board of Governors or the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that the conditions were no longer viewed as effective. Were you part of that communication process?
No, I was not.
So how did you reach your conclusion in your recommendation to the staff at the Board of Governors that the risk management rating at the Citigroup should be raised and the effective moratorium removed?
It was done through a number of, I guess, venues. One of them would have been an examination of the compliance monitoring and testing reporting program that I mentioned earlier. And the results of that exam showed that Citigroup was making significant progress, had made significant progress in developing a more robust monitoring, testing, and reporting process. That would have been one aspect that would have informed this decision. The second would have been the level of independence that was achieved in the compliance risk management function by placing the compliance function outside of the businesses and reporting up through Dave Bushnell as the chief risk officer. That would have been another aspect that would have gone into this. Efforts they made around the franchise governance reviews would have factored into this as well, and I think audits activities as far as enhancing audit staff, all of those would have gone into informing this assessment of upgrading the risk management function.
So let's assume hypothetically that Mr. Bushnell was too close to Mr. Maharis to be truly independent in the risk management function that was assigned to him. If it was sort of outside the scope of what you were doing, was there someone else here at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York who would have been looking at his actual relationship with the business unit heads and been charged with making a determination about whether his relationship was independent enough?
I think some of the coordinators that did more of the credit and market risk functions would probably have been closer. They were the ones meeting more regularly with people like B.B. Duke.
And who would those people be?
Probably
won't
ask Diane that, right?
Or Bill Hallisey, to some extent, and Antonio Alvarez might have a better understanding. Probably that function. Again, from an operational risk coordinator, my dealings were mostly with Martin Wong on the compliance side.
Right.
So where we did meet with Bushnell is more like in conveying some of the annual assessments of Citigroup, and that was pretty much my the opportunities I had to meet with Dave Bushnell.
And would whoever that person was, would they have had input into the recommendation about the risk management rating for Citigroup?
Yes. When we did the this was following our annual roll up for 2005, and that annual roll up process, the entire Citigroup supervisory team is at a table like this, and we're all discussing ratings from our individual risk disciplines. So there would be not only my observations that would have gone into this, but it would have considered the observations of any of the other risk coordinators, such as our market credit risk coordinators, all anyone on the team whose efforts may have touched, in some respect, compliance risk management, including the other legal and compliance risk coordinator as well.
So I'll mark as F-23, document dated April 10th, 2006. It's a memo to file from Eric Caban.
Caban.
Dated April 10th, 2006, base number 863 to 865. Is that a document that you would have seen when it was at or about the time it was produced?
Yes.
And in general, what is that document referencing? What process is it describing?
This would have been
take your time to.
Okay. This document was done as part of the planning process to a risk control self-assessment review that we conducted in 2006. And what we had, what we were doing was meeting with the I guess it would be the RCSA, not Citigroup's term, the RCSA controller for each business within Citigroup, for them to explain the risk control self-assessment process that was in place for that business. So in this case, I believe it's the global consumer group that we met with them so they could explain to us in the planning process what the risk control self-assessment process was, probably how they would report control issues through that process. And we would use those types of meetings to better inform our exam planning process and to be able to scope out our exam planning process. But we did that with all the major businesses at Citigroup.
So if we're looking at Citigroup's sort of functional pieces, this consumer group would have the subprime exposure that was direct from mortgage lending, mostly through City Financial, but also some through City Mortgage. The indirect exposure.
Just if I can clarify, City Financial is something I know a whole lot about, having been involved in the enforcement. They don't do mortgage lending, just to be clear. City Financial doesn't do first mortgage lending. They do personal loans. City Mortgage does mortgage lending. The Reg Z violations on them were because what they did is they would take personal loans and then convert them into second or third liens on people's homes, but they are not a first mortgage lender.
Did I say they were a first mortgage lender?
Yeah, you just said the mortgage lending, the subprime loans that were made by City Financial and City Mortgage, they're very different.
Right, but I didn't say first. They were second mortgages, weren't they?
Tiny. Like, they weren't what you would think of when you think of, like, a home equity line in the traditional sense.
Okay.
Just to be clear for your purposes.
No, thanks. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So in measuring Citigroup's aggregate subprime exposure, Some of it would be generated at City Financial. Some of it generated at City Mortgage in the direct lending. Whereas in the investment banking unit, you would have the RMBS business, and you'd also have the CDO desk. When you were doing sort of your view of their risk control self-assessment, was there any way that you would look across sort of business lines and say, okay, you know, silo A may be measuring their own exposure, but hey, guys, there's no overall sort of totaling up of our various subprime silos here or there. Did that conversation or concept or analysis play out? Was that something that happened or did occur, or was it something you thought about at the time?
That analysis would not have occurred through the risk control self-assessment process. The risk control self-assessment process was largely aimed at the adequacy of the firm's operational risk controls. So internal controls, segregation of duties, maybe information security related controls, technology related controls. Market and credit risk exposures would not have been generally reviewed as part of the risk control self-assessment process.
Is setting internal limits on exposures part of the risk control self-assessment process?
If a limit was overstated, or if a limit was breached, that could have been part of the risk control. That could have been picked up as part of the testing that would have been done on a quarterly basis. But the actual, is the limit appropriate? Or is the limit appropriate relative to the risk appetite of the firm or the business? That would not have been picked up through the risk control self-assessment process. So it would have been difficult to see how the exposures were being aggregated across the business through the risk control self-assessment process.
The next document, or I guess more accurately, two documents, I'm marking as F24, and it begins with Bates number 99649 and ends with 99652, and it relates to the C&D order on City Financial we discussed very briefly before. Were you involved in any way in the recommendation of the removal of the sanctions of that order?
To a large extent, no. There was another legal and compliance risk coordinator that handled more of the City Financial piece. We were both there at the same time, and that was primarily his responsibilities.
Okay. If you need to take a break,
I'm good.
Just let us know. So the next document I'm marking as F25 is a letter dated July 13th, 2006, beginning with Bates 87639, ending with Bates 87641. It's a letter to Suzanne Locke, Global Risk Management and Compliance, from Diane Dobeck. What's that? Are you familiar with this letter?
Yes, I am.
Did you participate in the creation of that document?
Yes, I did.
Can you generally describe what the purpose of that communication was?
This communication was the communication we made to the firm after the risk control self-assessment exam was completed in 2006. We alluded to it previously in the planning memo that was done by Eric Caban. This basically outlines the results of the examination and recommendations that we have for the risk control self-assessment process. I believe there were three recommendations in here that we required the firm to respond to, and again, that was a result of our exam processes.
Looking at the second page under risk acceptance, the first sentence says, management does not have an explicit risk acceptance process embedded in its RSCA framework, a practice observed at other large institutions. Can you explain that sentence to me?
What they're saying, and again, this relates to operational residual risk in the context of operational risks. So you can look at a business and say, inherently, this business is processing billions of dollars a day in transactions. There's just without looking at the level of controls relative to those processes, this is a high inherent risk within this business because they process billions of dollars of transactions a day. Then the firm would look at the controls relative to the processes that surround the processing of all these trades or whatever it is, transactions. If the control structure is well defined, if there's strong segregation of duties, perhaps good information security type controls, good management with respect to that, those controls and processes that are in place could mitigate the level of inherent risk within the business. At some point in time, they could have identified a gap in those controls or a control that just wasn't tight enough for the business, and because that gap exists, there could be some residual risk of a certain level that remains within that business. So you say going into the business, it's a high inherent risk, but given the level of controls and the processes that are in place, we rate that control environment as moderate. So it reduced the inherent level to moderate. What Eric was saying is that there wasn't an explicit sign-off through the risk control self-assessment process that, like an attestation or control sign-off, that the business manager accepted this level of risk for this business entity. And I think it's good to understand, too, that these risk control self-assessments were done at a level within the business that could have been it wasn't a broad corporate level, but each individual business, each business entity would have conducted numerous risk control self-assessments of their business processes. So some of these risk control self-assessment processes were quite specific and quite limited to certain aspects of a business. But whatever that residual risk that was left within the business, there wasn't an explicit sign-off by management. And again, operational risks.
So would with respect to creating a CDO or with respect to creating a CLO, a collateralized loan obligation from commercial credits, would the the aggregation of the underlying assets awaiting packaging and distribution, would that be a form of operational risk that would be something you would be concerned with, or is that viewed as a credit risk that someone else would be concerned with?
I think potentially it would be viewed more as a credit risk or as a market risk if these things are waiting to be sold, and the bank is at risk for some price fluctuation in these securities while they're in the pipeline to distribute. I believe that would be more of a market risk. I don't think it's something that would necessarily show up in a risk control self-assessment process.
Now, as I understand it in our conversations with the OCC, that as we've sort of briefly touched upon here, that both the OCC and the Board of Governors and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 2006 sort of went through this process of lifting various written agreements, cease and desist orders, the sanctions or limits from the approval, and there had been pressure building up at Citigroup prior to the lifting of those orders because the senior folks at Citigroup believed they were falling behind in the financial metrics compared to their competitors, and that what happened in hindsight is that as these series of agreements and limiting sanctions were removed, that after those various agreements, orders, and sanctions were removed, Citigroup embarked on an expansion of its risk profile sort of across the board. For example, the leveraged loan limit from 2006 to 2007, the aggregate exposure limit was originally $35 billion, got bumped up to $50 billion, and later bumped up to $100 billion. And then when the music stopped, the product couldn't be sold, and that ended up bouncing back onto the balance sheet of Citigroup and Citibank. In making an assessment of risk limitation, is there anything in that process that relates to this self-assessment of risks? Is that again entirely a credit function?
I think there would be some assessment within the risk control self-assessment process, and that would be do you have the controls in place that would support increased business within a given product? So are the appropriate levels of controls in place if you want to expand a product? That certainly you have to have, whether there be the appropriate technology systems, the appropriate internal controls, sign-offs, whatever the business would require with respect to, let's just say, for doubling the business. So you have to look at it from that perspective. I think also from a compliance risk management, you have to make certain that if it's a new business that they're embarking on, are the appropriate compliance risk management processes in place? Do they understand what laws, what regulations come into play? And that gets back to I mentioned previously about the compliance risk management, the strategic plans that were done by the countries, and those plans were done to make certain that the level of business activity that was being done within those countries, that those compliance risk management monitoring and testing programs were appropriate relative to that level of activity. So if they were looking to expand it significantly, Well, you might also have to ramp up the compliance risk management aspect piece of it. So certainly there would be aspects if you're looking to grow a business that would come to play within the risk control self-assessment process. And it would be both from a control perspective as well as a compliance risk management process.
So the next document I have is one we've previously marked as F-15. It's a roll-up presentation of Citigroup for 2006. So can you point out the sections of this presentation that you would have been responsible for?
Input to the legal and compliance risk slides in 2005. To some extent, the board order as it pertained to the 5-point plan, I would have had input to that.
Slides, are they the same as pages?
Slides, primarily slides 30 to 34, I believe. The overall
risk management
component
rating.
A big, significant piece of that came from the compliance risk management upgrades there. Do you want me to go through each of the pages?
Let's flip to page, 30? Is that where your section starts? If the pages are the same as the slides. So legal and compliance, this is page 29. What have you had input into those rankings?
Yes, I would have.
So,
Page 6, right? Yes.
So tell me what these various categories, board and management oversight, policies, procedure limits, monitoring, and internal controls.
Okay. For all of the risk management components, whether they be legal compliance, operational, credit, market and liquidity, there's four components that are rated within the risk management piece. Those four components are here: board and management oversight, policies, procedures, and limits, monitoring and MIS reporting, and internal controls. Board and management oversight gets at the senior, obviously the board of directors and the adequacy of the senior management within the organization. It gets at training and development of both senior management and staff. It gets at compensation issues. So the compensation issues I mentioned previously about was compensation tied to the level of internal controls that would have been factored into this this category as well. For policies and procedures and limits, it generally gets at the adequacy of formalized policies, procedures, and limits. In 2006, I would have had some input into this. I also would have had some input into the operational aspects towards the latter half of the year. I started doing some of the operational risk management activities as well, and so I would have had some input into that, but more of my year would have been spent in legal and compliance. So again, it deals primarily with our adequate policies and procedures in place throughout the organization. For monitoring and MIS reporting, this addresses primarily how does the firm monitor risks relative to each discipline, what type of MIS do they have on a regular basis that would go to senior management and the board of directors, and how do they report various issues with respect to each of these risk management disciplines. And internal controls, you would find largely any issues with respect to internal or external audit, the adequacy of internal controls, the adequacy of the, in this case, city's risk control self-assessment process, SOX-related controls, so anything dealing with the internal control environment of the organization would have been factored into here.
So speaking of compensation, did you actually look at the compensation agreements and structures for someone like Mr. Maharis, who is the head of the investment bank side of the...
We didn't look at the actual agreements, but what we did do was we met with HR. I know we met with them in 2005, 2006. I don't know if it was once or twice, but we met with them and at the end of the year to understand how they went about making the compensation decisions relative to the senior most officers at Citigroup. And basically, they had a huge binder for which included all of the senior officers, and they were able to show us, going through the binder, how the compensation package, how the internal control environment, how any audit issues or compliance issues were factored into the compensation package of the senior officers. And they didn't take us through each officer, but they had a number of presentations around the overall portfolio of senior officers and how they were impacted by the control issues with respect to their businesses and how it would have impacted their actual compensation.
So I'll represent to you that for 2006, Mr. Maharis was paid in excess of $30 million. And his agreement with Citigroup contained a limited clawback provision that simply applied to, I believe, fraud or other unlawful conduct. Did you, as part of your review or discussion with HR, ever discuss the clawback provisions or the scope of the clawback provisions?
I don't recall discussing clawback provisions at this point in time. I think the main focus at this point in time was that the compensation was tied. What was the evidence that Citigroup could provide to us that the compensation program was somehow tied to the internal control structure that was in place at the organization, and if there was a internal control issues, how would that have impacted the compensation for a senior officer? And that was largely at the senior officer level.
So sort of looking back now, in hindsight, do you think that Citigroup's compensation structure for its senior-most managers provided an appropriate set of incentives in 2006 for those senior managers, or do you think that there could have been a better structure in place?
I think given the issues that Citi was facing at that time, I think the incentive structure was appropriately focused on, you know, compliance issues, internal control issues, you know, repeat audit issues. I'd say we were focusing at in 2005 and 2006 that Citi had had a number of very high-profile compliance issues and had some high-profile internal control issues with respect to information security and things of that nature, that our thinking at that time was there needs to be some way of tying compensation to those types of issues. And I that's generally what the thinking was at that point in time.
So one of those high-profile issues was the, I believe it was popularly dubbed the Dr. Evil bond trading mm-hmm. problem, dealing with European sovereign debt. Wasn't that under Mr. Maharis's supervision?
If it was, I didn't directly look at that with that one.
So going on to page 30, is this essentially your work? Considerable level of compliance risk is managed satisfactorily? Is that something that
yes.
you produced?
Yes, that's something I would have had feedback in, or I would have been involved in formulating, yes.
And this sort of reflects what we've been discussing about
yes.
their operational risk and controls that they
yes.
implemented under the five points plan.
Yeah, and this largely refers to the monitoring, testing, and reporting exam and continued improvements there. Yes.
On to page 32, reputational risk management efforts related to WA, which I assume means written agreement follow-up. So this would have been sort of outside your scope. This would be more in Bard's.
For the most part, yes. There were some high-level committee that I may have attended, but for the most part, that was Bard's.
Turning to page 35, this bullet point at the top, this is operational risk,
right.
Continues to be inherently high and managed in a satisfactory manner. can you explain what that
sure,
means?
Sure. And I think it's important to note, too, somewhere around August, September of 2006, my responsibilities changed, and I was doing more operational risk coordination work. So I had some input into this. But what this means is, I made reference to it earlier, that if you look at a business absent controls, what is the level of inherent risk within that business? And for Citigroup, given its very and we're talking operational risk here now, given its huge geographic footprint, given the level of transactions that Citigroup processes on a daily basis, within this operational risk bucket, the global transaction services side of Citigroup would be factored into They're a huge processing institution. So given the type of business that Citi is involved in, the risk is seen as inherently high risk, but that the controls are such that it is managed in a satisfactory manner from an operational risk perspective. So dealing with internal controls, the appropriateness of policies, the adequacy of the audit program, the adequacy of the risk control self-assessment process, and makes reference here to SOX processes as well.
So the next document I have is one we've previously labeled F18, and it's titled Citigroup Year in Review, and it's dated January 11, 2007. On the first page, well, first of all, why don't you take a look at that? So on the first page, it goes through the formal actions lifted, the board order restricting significant expansion, the cease and desist with respect to Citi Financial, the written agreement, the post-Enron agreement. Second page, it talks about the bank consolidation and the financial highlights. And on the third page, it talks about some topics, including subprime lending. From our discussion today, I would take that the only thing you had significant input on would be the section on the board order restricting significant expansion, or is there some other piece of this that you would have been involved in?
Yeah. My most significant input would be in the board order restricting significant expansion. Most of the work here was done by Bard. Bank consolidation, financial crisis. Yeah. Peripherally, at the end of the written agreement, I came in a little bit, but by that point in time, I think the majority of the work around the written agreement was completed. But yes, my significant involvement would have been in this area.
Do you know if this was circulated to you before it was finished? Do you recall?
Given that we had significant input into it, I think we would have done this in pieces. Whether the entire briefing memo would have been circulated to all of us, I'm not certain of, but certainly I would have had involvement in formulating this.
we, 26 or 27?
We are on 25, so we're at 26.
So this is a document dated November 1st, 2006, Bates number 920 to 924. And it's titled Meeting with CIB Compliance to Citigroup CPC Team and Compliance M&T Exam Team. Is that a document you're familiar with?
It's a document that would have been put together on the monitoring, testing, and reporting team. So I don't know if I was at the meeting, but I would have been familiar with the circumstances, most likely, yes. I'm trying to look for my name.
Yeah, I didn't see it there.
I actually had some medical issues during that exam, and it may have been why, but I'm familiar with the exam, actually.
The last document that I'll mark is F-27. It's a letter dated June 9th, 2006 from David Bushnell and Michael Helfer, and it's Bates 939 to 949. I want to take a look at that. Do you recall seeing this at about the time it was received by the Federal Reserve Bank?
Yes, this would have been the firm's reply to the annual exam from 2005, at which point in time I would have been involved in the compliance risk management efforts.
So turning to page 3, under the risk and control self-assessment section, it says, as you know, we recently reissued a streamlined RSCA and operational risk policy to make RSCAs more efficient and more effective as a tool to help manage risk. Under the policy, each RSCA will now be targeted to focus on, quote, important risks, and, quote,
T controls.
Mm-hmm.
So from a sort of a layman's perspective, can you explain sort of what they mean by we're going to focus on important risks? What?
Sure. Prior to this being in, this policy being in place, the risk control self-assessment process would basically test every control at Citigroup, and whether or not the risk was something seen as an important risk to the firm, or whether it was merely a control that had maybe no financial risk or no significant bearing on a business on a given process. So from this point on, the risk control self-assessment process was streamlined to capture that the important risks that a business would go through and consider what are the important risks of this business and what are the key controls for this business. It would capture those processes and test those risks and controls on a quarterly basis as opposed to every single control within a business. That process was the process of determining what an important control or a key control was conducted within the businesses to ascertain that they were capturing the appropriate level of risks and controls.
So going back to the leveraged loan pipeline, which over a one-year time frame from 2006 to 2007, risk management approved the increase from $35 billion to $50 billion to $100 billion. So certainly it meets sort of a compliance test, right, because they're following
the
steps and procedures. But from a larger risk measurement standpoint, one can say there might have been issues with tripling a limit that fast in an area that ended up having significant amounts of risk in it. Do you think that's the sort of thing that should have been sort of, if not a compliance risk, should have been subject to more rigorous internal review at Citigroup under some heading of risk management, even if it wasn't compliance risk?
I guess you could say that some aspect of setting the risk appetite should have been done. It would not have been picked up in a risk control self-assessment process. What would have been picked up is what is the limit, and are we within within that limit? So
increasing the limits doesn't trigger anything under the risk control self-assessment. As long as you keep orderly increasing the limits, risk control self-assessment is going to say it's okay.
It's okay.
And it's up to some other function to say, whoa.
The risk management function pushing back on management saying, is this risk limit appropriate for this business? And I think you'd have to rely on the risk management function as that check with the business to say this limit is doubling or tripling, whatever it is. Why is that the case? And that's where I would look to see if those types of questions were being asked of the business management by risk management.
Okay. Well, we've exhausted my limited knowledge of compliance risk management. So this is sort of your opportunity if you want to say anything to add to the record about what you think about what happened at Citigroup in small pieces or large piece or whatever you think is appropriate.
Okay. I've thought, I guess, quite a bit. You know, what happened at Citigroup, and was there something from an operational risk perspective that I missed? And as we said, looking at the risk control self-assessments from an operational risk perspective, there wasn't anything in there. If the risk limit is doubled or tripled, there wasn't something there from an operational risk perspective that I might have seen. I don't think either that we saw the crisis and the subprime crisis unfolding. We didn't foresee it unfolding as quickly as it did, and as having such an impact that it did so quickly. That's not something we saw coming. You can look back at the systems and see how they aggregated their. How does an organization like Citigroup aggregate its risk exposures across businesses, and do they have the appropriate systems to both aggregate the risk and if it's a subprime direct exposure here, but it might be a collateral exposure here, it's something I thought about. I think in the crisis, one thing we learned is that the risk systems that an organization has to have in place are the types of systems that need real-time information. You need to be able to make decisions and get this type of information on a real-time basis. And if there is a shortcoming in a risk system in good times, maybe you don't pick that up until things have already happened. And with the speed of the crisis and the impact so quickly and so hard, I think it was perhaps too late to make a difference once it started happening, once it happened, and once you saw what the exposures were. It all came together very quickly. It all fell apart very quickly, and I think the risk systems didn't capture it, and I'm not certain that the bank or the regulators really understood the exposures soon enough to be able to do something about it. And, we all played a role in that process. I don't know if I have anything else to say.
It's your nickel.
Your core.
Any comments on your interaction with any of the other agencies?
We worked really hard to in our interactions with the OCC from an operational risk perspective. I didn't have as much interaction on the board order with the legal and compliance folks. I had some, but from an operational risk perspective, with the OCC, we worked hard at developing a good working relationship, a good collaborative relationship with the OCC examiners. From a technology perspective, they had quite a large staff on site.
Right.
And we would leverage that staff, and I think we had a very good working relationship with them. But we also had expertise on our staff that we would lend to them. They did an information security exam, and we had two of our better information security examiners working on that exam that was led by their. One of their senior technology people. So, from an operational risk perspective, we had a good relationship with the OCC. They recognized where we could lend expertise. Payment system risk is one area where they saw us as having more expertise, and we participated on their payment system risk exams because they fell within the national bank, that activity. So you worked at it, but for at least on the operational risk side, it was a good process. I think they had respect for our knowledge, and we had respect for their knowledge and their resources, and we made it work together. I'd say one other thing that we kind of didn't talk about is it wasn't only the on-site team for the Federal Reserve, because we did have we did use our pool of risk examiners,
mm-hmm.
and we explained this process to Citigroup, how it worked. We had a huge pool of examiners that would participate in Citigroup-related exams, but we also had the expertise of what we called the risk specialty officers. There was one for operational risk, there was one for credit market, and they had kind of subgroupings of kind of like subject matter experts within those disciplines, and you know, the technology person, we brought them to the table at Citigroup when we were talking with the chief technology officer. I know from a legal and compliance perspective, we look to do the same thing with compliance people that were our risk examiners. So we had a lot of expertise that we could pull from, and at least in my discipline, that expertise, I think they looked forward to being on the Citigroup exam because the level, the type of business, the significance of the institution, they looked forward to bringing their expertise to bear there, and also interacting with some of the some very respected people in the businesses. So we had when we asked for resources, at least on the operational risk side, we had good relationships with our risk examiners, and we usually found good resources to bring to bear, whether it was on our exam or an OCC exam. So it was a good relationship.
Okay. Well, it's a little after 4 o'clock, and unless anyone has anything else to say, this interview is concluded. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.